Captain Heron said it was a miracle that more of the wounded did not die. And that miracle was named Doc Loose. Heron says, I am convinced that one of the major reasons that the platoon came through as well as it did was due to the actions of Specialist 5, Charles Loose, the medic. Every man I talked with in the platoon unanimously credited Doc Loose with saving the men who were badly wounded. Lieutenant Dennis Deal was one of the first to reach the platoon. We couldn't see each other. I yelled, are you guys still there? The answer came back, yes, we're here. I walked over to where my friend Henry Herrick was laying dead, and I stood looking down at him. It was so hot, so horribly hot, that his body had already begun to smell. I did not want to remember him that way, so I turned away and occupied myself with other duties. But I have. Sergeant Savage says the first men who walked into his perimeter couldn't see him or his men. All the artillery had blown dirt and dust on us, and we looked like part of the ground. It was curious, Deal says. The men who had survived didn't stand up. They just lay there in the shallow body holes they had scratched in the ground. They were still in a state of shock because of what they had been through. Specialist Galen Bungum. The first man I saw was Lieutenant Ken Duncan, the B Company executive officer. I hollered at him to get down. He said, it's okay, come on, let's go. Then he threw me one of his canteens. More troops were standing around and I thought they were nuts. We couldn't believe it. None of us would get up. After some coaxing, we got up slow. Lieutenant Deal saw a lot of dead North Vietnamese soldiers literally within feet of the Americans and one still alive. One North Vietnamese was sitting against a tree, shot up terribly. But he continued to try to pull a grenade from his pouch. He still wanted, before he died, to get that grenade off. I was very impressed by that total dedication. He tried, until he finally died, to get that grenade out of his pouch, and we stood there and watched him. He couldn't lift it more than a couple of inches, and then it would fall back and he would start trying all over again. Platoon Sergeant Larry Gilreath says, the thing I remember most was the peaceful way that Sergeant Palmer looked, laying on his back with his hands folded on his chest. We had gotten pretty close, and I almost lost it when I saw him. Then there was the way that each of them asked for water. And here I was with only about half a canteen to give them. That went fast. I was helping one of them, Sergeant Thompson, I think. He was wounded, could hardly walk, and he asked me for a drink of water. I don't think at that time there was a gallon of water in the whole battalion. Such a small thing like that, and I couldn't give him a drink of water. One of the troopers called Lieutenant Deal's attention to something lying on the ground. The man said, look, there's something red, and I don't know what it is. It was a book that a North Vietnamese soldier had dropped. It was filled with beautiful writing, beautiful script. It was the jottings of a homesick young soldier. Poetry, notes, letters. A sample. Oh, my dear, my young wife, when the troops come home after the victory and you do not see me, please look at the proud colors. You will see me there. And you will feel warm under the shadow of the bamboo tree. As Dennis Deal helped prepare the men and weapons for evacuation, he vividly remembers one other scene. It was the final act of a North Vietnamese soldier who was killed. Before he died, he took a hand grenade and held it against the stock of his weapon. Then he had gotten on his knees and bent over double. If anybody tried to get his weapon, they were going to activate that hand grenade. When I saw the dedication of those two Vietnamese with their hand grenades, I said to myself, we are up against an enemy who is going to make this a very long year. Although the relief force had gotten in without major incident, they now began taking more small arms fire from unseen marksmen. Captain Bennett, securing the eastern half of the clearing, got new orders to spread his platoons out and cover the entire perimeter. In the process of doing that, Bennett and two of his men were shot by snipers. The sudden outbreak of enemy firing lent new urgency to the mission. Bob Tully and I agreed that the priority task was to collect Savage and his men and their weapons. No body counting, no searching for enemy equipment, no hanging around. Just get the hell out of there. We didn't want to press our luck. It was now 3:30 p.m., and there was plenty of work to be done before dark. Evacuation of our dead and wounded, resupply flights of ammo and water, patrols out of the perimeter, integrating Tully's battalion into the American lines, clearing fields of fire, registering defensive fires, setting out trip flares, flares set off by trip wires close to the ground. Says Tully, "Our next concern was the actual movement of the personnel of the isolated platoon back to X-ray. Many of them needed to be carried. Strange as it may seem, evacuating their casualties, plus a few of our own, took the greater part of two companies. Carrying wounded and dead men in the jungle in makeshift litters is no easy job when you have some distance to travel. And trying to maintain a good tactical posture under those circumstances is difficult. Troops are milling around. Litter bearers become tired and need to be replaced. I concentrated on moving the casualties out as quickly as possible and securing the movement back to X-ray in an organized fashion. Up on the knoll, final preparations for the move were underway," says Sergeant Larry Gilreath. "After we policed up the area, making sure that everyone was accounted for and that all their weapons were picked up, I asked Sergeant Savage if I could help carry Sergeant Palmer. He told me that would be fine." Lieutenant Deal says, "I remember somebody saying, 'Now we have them all.' I turned around. Just at that point, the litter bearers who were carrying Henry Herrick's body set his litter down, and I looked back and saw Henry's face in the red dirt. His head was hanging over the end of that litter. I don't know why those kind of memories remain with you so long after the event. It seems so unnatural for my friend to be laying stomach down with his face in that red dirt. I recalled as I was looking at him that Colonel Moore had permitted a small number of troops to leave the ship when it docked in Long Beach, California, on the way to Vietnam. Lieutenant Herrick was one of the few people who had family in that area and was given a pass to go visit his mother and father. As I looked at him, I remembered that, and I was glad he had that last chance to see them. I have since been to Henry Herrick's grave in Arlington. It's right near the Tomb of the Unknowns on a beautiful hillside. A tree grows above it, shading the headstone. On the other side of the Tomb of the Unknowns is Captain Tom Metzger's grave." Lieutenant Colonel Bob Tully took one last look around, then gave the order to head east for X-ray. Specialist Galen Bungham, his ordeal nearly at an end, had one last unsettling experience as he staggered down toward X-ray. "I remember stumbling and falling down, ending up face to face with a dead enemy with his eyes wide open. I will never forget that." Just before 4 p.m., Matt Dillon got the radio call from Tully's operations officer advising that the relief force was now an estimated 15 minutes away from X-ray. Dillon told Lieutenant Tiff to start calling in the helicopters. Then Tully's force began closing on the perimeter. It was a bittersweet moment. Happy, relieved, and grateful to get that platoon back, I walked over to Tully and thanked him and his men. I shook hands with Ernie Savage and told him that he and his men had done a great job in the worst sort of situation. Then there was the sobering, grim sight of the dead and wounded of Herrick's platoon. The dead lay on their poncho litters. Two or three of the wounded came in on their own feet, half walking, half carried on the shoulders of their friends. Some of those who had survived without a scratch were so drained that they also required help. Captain Carrara, Sergeant Keaton, and Sergeant Keith quickly set to work tending the wounded. The dead were gently laid at the edge of the clearing, their booted feet awry and unmoving and somehow so terribly sad. My eyes passed over Sergeant Carl Palmer and like Larry Gilreath, I was stopped by the peaceful expression, that half-smile on his face. Sergeant Gilreath helped cover the faces of the dead with their ponchos and then walked over to Sergeant Major Plumley. Somewhere along the way, I picked up a .45 caliber pistol and didn't realize I had it until we got to the CP. Plumley asked me if I knew that it was fully cocked, hammered back, and fully loaded. We decided that I would sit down and safe it. The helicopters began coming in. Lieutenant Dick Merchant was now in charge of the landing zone. I still remember loading Sergeant Palmer and Sergeant Hurdle. I broke away to see John Heron in Bravo Company. He described the magnificent performance by the 2nd Platoon. His first words were, "Dick, we almost lost your platoon." He was exhausted, but still the same solid, thinking John Heron I had known as my company commander. As Savage, Bungum, and the others came into the command post, Joe Galloway talked briefly to each of them. They were like men who had come back from the dead. We were all filthy, but they were beyond filthy. Their fatigue uniforms were ripped and torn, their eyes were bloodshot holes in the red dirt that was ground into their faces. I asked each man his name and hometown and wrote them down carefully in my notebook, along with something of what they had gone through. The headline writers dubbed them the Lost Platoon when my story moved on the wire. Somehow Galen Bungum, Joe F. Mackey, and Specialist 4 Wayne M. Anderson, who had not been wounded, were put on an outbound helicopter and ended back at base camp in Anhe. The four other unhurt members of the 2nd Platoon were sent back to duty on the X-ray perimeter. Says Savage, "We got back online in the creek bed not far from the anthill. PFC Russell P. Hicks had brought the machine gun back. There was a lot of firing going on that afternoon. No major attack, but a lot of snipers to deal with." Within half an hour after the Tully Task Force had returned to X-ray, Brigadier General Richard Knowles came up on the radio asking permission to land. He says, "We came in fast. I jumped out of my chopper, departed. Morale was high and the 1st Battalion 7th Cav was doing a great job. I gave Hal a cigar and he quickly briefed me on the situation. Lieutenant Colonel John Stoner, our Air Force liaison officer, had accompanied me. I had been riding Stoner to get the air support in close. As Hal finished his briefing, an airstrike hit a target adjacent to the command post. The ground trembled and a bomb fragment flew into the CP area, 10 or 15 feet away from where we were standing. John Stoner walked over and gingerly picked up the smoking shrapnel, came back and handed it to me. "Generals, this close enough?" Before leaving, General Knowles told us that he would direct Tim Brown to pull my battalion and the attached units out of X-ray the next day and fly us back to Camp Holloway for 2 days of rest and rehabilitation. But for now, we face the prospect of another long night defending this perimeter. Dylan and I worked out a way to integrate Tully's battalion into the lines. We tightened our own lines and placed Tully's men on the eastern and northern parts of the perimeter, generally facing away from the mountain toward the valley. I kept my own battalion plus the two attached rifle companies from 2nd Battalion 7th Cavalry where they were, covering narrower segments of the line but still controlling the areas where most of the fighting had occurred. The officers and men knew that ground well by now, and this was not the time to undertake major shifts in the disposition of our forces. Tully set up his battalion command post in a grove of trees about 40 yards north of mine. Ammunition, water, and rations were distributed, with the primary focus again on getting plenty of ammunition down to every rifleman, every machine gun, and every mortar tube. The four line companies of the 1st Battalion 7th Cav were now down to a total of 8 officers and 260 men. Charlie Company this morning had lost 42 men killed, 2 lieutenants, 16 sergeants, and 24 troopers. They had also suffered 20 wounded, their captain, 2 other lieutenants, 2 sergeants, and 15 troopers. Charlie Company was no longer combat effective as a rifle company. But we had a fresh battalion plus those 2 rifle companies from the 2nd Battalion 7th Cav. With only light probes at the perimeter during the afternoon, the line companies had ample time to reorganize for the night ahead. Chapter 15. Night Fighters. There is many a boy here today who looks on war as all glory. But boys, it is all hell. William Tecumseh Sherman. Captain Myron F. Diederich, commander of Bravo Company 2nd Battalion 7th Cavalry, had a strong hunch that he and his men, now occupying the old Charlie Company positions, would be attacked in strength this night, and he lost no time convincing his men that the enemy were coming and they had best get ready for a fight. In Myron Diederich and Lieutenant Rick Rescorla, Bravo Company 2nd Battalion had two foreign-born officers whose accents and gung-ho attitudes lent a touch of foreign legion flair. The Ukrainian Diederich and the Englishman Rescorla were destined, over the next 72 hours, to become battlefield legends in the 7th Cavalry, as much for their style as for their fearless leadership under fire. Having spent the afternoon preparing his platoon positions, Rick Rescorla walked back to Diederich's command post, Bob Edwards' old foxhole, just about dusk. "Are your men up for this?" asked Diederich. "Do you feel they can hold?" Rescorla replied, "We're as ready as we'll ever be. But if they break through us, sir, you'll be the first to know. This CP is less than 50 yards behind us." The mad Cossack had no patience now for Rescorla's usual banter. "Damn it, Hardcore, cut the shit!" Diederich snapped. "Stay alert! We're counting on you!" Diederich, then 27, had commanded this company since May. He was eager and aggressive, yet totally professional. Over the next 3 days and nights, he would emerge as the finest battlefield company commander I had ever seen, bar none. He operated on the basic principle of maximum damage with minimum loss. Diederich's men had had 3 or 4 quiet hours of daylight to prepare for what was coming, and they made the most of it. His company, with the 3rd Platoon Alpha Company, 2nd Battalion, 7th Cav attached, now held the same 140 yards of perimeter that Bob Edwards' men had secured. Lieutenant William Sisson's platoon of the same company was on the left, PFC John C. Martin, 25 of Wichita, Kansas, among them. Martin says, "We set our perimeter and started digging our 2-man fighting positions. I remember Platoon Sergeant Charles L. Eschbach came around to each position. Dig it deeper and build a bigger and higher parapet. Set up fields of fire. Stay alert. We were all scared out of our wits, but we put being scared in the back of our minds and concentrated on what we were told. We continued to improve our positions even though the ground was hard. It was like digging through concrete. I remember, I'll always remember, First Sergeant Frank Miller standing there, no helmet on, his bald head shining, smoking a cigar." Myron Diederich and his soldiers had not yet been sorely tested, but soon they would be. During that lull, Diederich made certain that fields of fire and observation were cleared out to beyond 200 yards. That good fighting positions were dug, that machine guns were placed in positions that assured flanking, interlocking fire, that trip flares and anti-intrusion devices were installed as far as 300 yards out, that every man was loaded down with ammunition, and that ammo resupply points were designated, that all radios were checked and double-checked. Then Diederich worked very carefully with the artillery forward observer, registering pre-planned fires all across his front. The officer, Lieutenant William Lund, had 4 batteries, 24 howitzers, registered and adjusted and on call. Bill Lund, a 23-year-old native of Edina, Minnesota, was an ROTC graduate of the University of Minnesota. He spent his first night in Landing Zone X-Ray learning the real world of close-in fire support. Artillery school solutions in those days considered 400 yards dangerously close. Lund discovered that in X-Ray, the big shells had to be brought down to within 40 to 50 yards if you wanted to stay alive. Says Lund, "Myron Diederich and I were side by side all the time. so I had an infantryman's knowledge of what was happening. Rick Riscorla, 1st Platoon leader, was 6 months out of OCS at the infantry school at Fort Benning. But he had arrived there with a wealth of good training already under his belt. He had served in the British Army in Cyprus and with the Colonial Police in Rhodesia, and he knew what soldiering was all about. What he did to prepare his position and his men speaks for his professionalism. I met with Lieutenant Bill Sisson, A27, who would be on my left flank. Sisson, a personal friend from OCS class of April 1965, looked around at the dead NVA soldiers and wrinkled his nose. They were starting to get ripe. "Wish you were back in submarines?" I asked. Sisson wore twin dolphins on his chest from Navy Reserve duty in Rhode Island. Convinced that the NVA would come back that night, we vowed to tie in our sectors tight as a duck's ass. No weak links. Riscorla walked the terrain and tried to see it from the enemy's point of view. Scrub trees, elephant grass, anthills, and some ground cover stretched to the front. The ground was not as flat as it first appeared, but had seams and thick ruts stretching off to the south, with a slight incline away from his positions. The hasty prone shelters dug by Charlie Company 1st Battalion had been dug after nightfall under enemy pressure. Riscorla moved his men back 50 yards, which not only shortened the sector but meant the enemy would now have to leave the trees and cross 40 yards of mostly open area to reach the Bravo Company foxholes. Riscorla recalls, "Because of our shortened lines, I decreased the number of foxholes. Three manholes were constructed. The M60 machine guns were set on principal directions of fire from which they could switch to final protective grazing fire, interlocking with each other and with the machine guns on our flanks. Foxholes and parapets were built in detail. I tested the holes. Some were so deep the occupants could not even see over the parapet. In these cases, firing steps were built back up. 2 hours before dusk, Sergeant Eschbach, A27, and Sergeant Thompson organized a booby trap detail. Carefully, they rigged grenades and trip flares far out on the main avenues of approach. Claymore mines would have iced the cake, but somewhere they had been lost. A screw-up, but I felt we were ready to tangle with the best of the North Vietnamese. Then after talking with Captain Diederich about defensive air, artillery, and mortar fires, Riscorla made a final walk of the line, visiting the neighboring 2nd Platoon. He says, "The gap-toothed James Lamont was part of the group on our right flank. He was the loudest mouth in the company, but a hard worker and good for morale. I asked, 'When the firing starts, are you guys going to stick around? If you are going to bug out, let me know.' But this time they understood my gallows humor. 'Sir, we'll still be here in the morning. Just make sure the hardcore, Riscorla's platoon, doesn't cut and run.'" The troops let their macho humor run wild. Sergeant Eschbach, a slightly built, hard-bitten 43-year-old NCO out of Detroit, walked over from Lieutenant Sisson's platoon and joined in. "I'm selling tickets on the next chopper to Pleiku," I told him. "Shit, sir. I wouldn't miss this one," Eschbach said, then looked down at the Randall knife on my belt and added, "But if I decide to bug out, I'll come over and pick up that knife from you." This kind of spirit showed the confidence I was looking for. Men scribbling forget-me-not letters to their next of kin were worthless, but these were men who believed they could win. I left them with some last words of advice. "They will come at us fast and low, no neat targets. Keep your fire at the height of a crawling man. Make them pass through a wall of steel. That's the only thing that will keep them out of your foxholes." PFC Richard Carger, a native of Los Angeles, who at 19 was one of the youngest soldiers in the outfit, asked Lieutenant Riscorla, "What if they break through?" Riscorla's response, "If they break through and overrun us, put grenades around your hole. Lay them on the parapet and get your head below ground. Lie on your back in your hole. Spray bullets into their faces. If we do our job, they won't get that far." The troops walked back to the holes and Riscorla moved off to his platoon command post, a small termite hill that had been used by Lieutenant Jack Gahagan the night before. Gahagan's body had been found there. but was only 20 yards behind the line of new deep foxholes. Back at the battalion command post, I made my own final checks. We were in excellent shape and morale was high. The perimeter was beefed up. We had plenty of ammo and medical supplies. All our casualties had been evacuated. Air and artillery had us precisely fixed and ranged in. Continuous close-in H&I, harassment and interdiction fire would begin at dusk and continue throughout the night. Instructions were passed demanding tight fire and light discipline. No mortar fires would be permitted without my personal approval, and especially no mortar illuminating rounds. I wanted the mortars to hold back their illumination rounds for our last light in the sky in case the air and artillery folks used up all their flares. By 7:30, it was dead dark. We looked forward to the moon rising. It was so black. But in those first 4 hours of night, except for light probing fire here and there on the perimeter, the North Vietnamese made no moves against us. Before midnight, we got a transmission from brigade headquarters. My battalion would be pulled out of X-ray the next day and sent back to Camp Holloway. The word came down to Dillon, through the operations channel. A bright near full moon was out by 11:20 p.m. Around midnight, Lieutenant Colonel Edward C. Shy Meyer, 3rd Brigade Executive Officer, passed me an astonishing message. General William Westmoreland's headquarters wanted me to leave X-ray early the next morning for Saigon to brief him and his staff on the battle. I could not believe I was being ordered out before the battle was over. I was also perplexed that Division or Brigade HQ had not squelched such an incomprehensible order before it reached me. My place was clearly with my men. Even as that message arrived, North Vietnamese automatic weapons fire opened up forward of Rick Riscorla's platoon, and a stream of green tracer fire hooked over his command post at a height of 15 feet. Riscorla and his radio operator crawled forward and rolled into a hole, joining PFC Curtis Gordon from Detroit. Riscorla, estimating that the enemy guns were at least 500 yards out, suspected that the enemy was just testing the perimeter, and ordered his men to cease firing. Then at about 1 a.m., a 5-man enemy probe was launched against the center of John Herron's Bravo Company, 1st Battalion Lines, 40 yards due west of the battalion command post. Some enemy rounds snapped over our heads. 2 of the 5 enemy were killed. The others slipped back into the jungle shadows. That probe, added to the firing forward of Riscorla's lines, were ominously similar to the enemy actions of the previous night, and a clear-cut warning that the North Vietnamese hadn't given up on X-ray yet. Tied up with these actions, I had not had time to respond to the order for me to leave for Saigon. Finally, around 1:30 a.m., I got Shy Meyer on the radio and registered my objections to the order in no uncertain terms. I made it very clear that this battle was not over and that my place was with my men, that I was the first man of my battalion to set foot in this terrible killing ground, and I damned well intended to be the last man to leave. That ended that. I heard no more on the matter. Out on the line, it was quiet but tense. Myron Diederich says, "During the hours after midnight, I received reports from my platoon leaders of strange sounds forward of our lines. In addition, a high-pitched sound of some type could be heard during the stillness between firing of artillery H&I fires. Whistles later found on dead enemy soldiers provided the answer. The enemy apparently used the whistles and a prearranged number of long and short blasts to control the assembly and movement of troops as they massed for attack." Rick Riscorla says that during the periods of silence, he encouraged talk between the foxholes to ease the tension. When all else failed, Riscorla sang "Wild Colonial Boy" and a Cornish favorite, "Going Up Camborne Hill," slow and steady tunes, which were answered by shouts of "Hardcore" and "Gary Owen" that told him his men were standing firm. Just before 4 a.m., Captain Diederich saw and heard indisputable evidence that the enemy was moving against his lines. At approximately 0400 warning devices, trip flares, and anti-intrusion devices, indicated quite a bit of movement in front of the 3rd Platoon, A27, and my 1st and 3rd Platoons. Some devices were as far forward as 300 yards. It appeared that the enemy was spreading out along a probable line of attack. It also appeared that they were executing a non-supported night attack, since supporting weapons other than the 40mm rockets were not used by the enemy. Although the hand grenade booby traps and trip flares were exploding, no enemy could yet be seen. That rapidly changed. At 4:22 a.m., Lieutenant Sisson radioed Diederich, "I see them coming. Can I shoot at them?" The platoons were under strict fire discipline to conserve ammo. Lieutenant Lund recalls Captain Diederich asking Sisson, "How close are they?" When Sisson replied, "I can almost touch them." Myron's immediate response was, "Go! Kill them!" According to Lieutenant Colonel Huang Phuong, the 7th Battalion, 66th Regiment, had come back with reinforcements and was again knocking on the southern and southeastern door to landing zone X-ray. The H-15 Viet Cong Battalion was assisting in the attack, as well as carrying ammunition and collecting the wounded. In his diary, Diederich described the scene. "My left and center platoons were under heavy attack by North Vietnamese battalion. You could see those bastards come in waves, human waves. We greeted them with a wall of steel. I called for illumination. Lieutenant Lund called for direct support from 4 105mm howitzer batteries. These batteries gave us continuous fires using point detonating and airburst explosions. The foliage and trees to the front favored use of both fuses. We fired some white phosphorus also." For Bill Lund, it was a forward observer's wildest dream of a target come true. "Enemy in the open," he radioed back to the gunners. Masses of the enemy swarmed toward Diederich's lines, clearly illuminated in the eerie light of swinging parachute flares fired by the howitzers. Diederich and Lund were in the foxhole command post together, with Diederich firmly in control. Diederich wrote, "The artillery was not fired on the same targets continuously. Lieutenant Lund had each of the four batteries fire a different defensive concentration and shifted their fires laterally and in depth in 100-yard adjustments. Later inspection of the battlefield revealed that this type of fire inflicted quite a punishment on the enemy." The initial enemy ground attack came against Lieutenant Sisson, then slanted toward Rescorla's platoon as well. Rick Rescorla recalls, "M16s jammed and every third man was down on the bottom of the holes with a cleaning rod clearing the rifles. Hot brass showered down the neck of the luckless reloader. The NVA came forward in short rushes, dropping, firing, pushing nearer. Whistles, shrill fierce voices of NVA non-coms kicking their men forward. A rocket-propelled grenade passed by with a rush of air. The spare rifles from Gehagen's dead platoon kept us up and firing, while our own were being cleared of jams." The first rush by at least 300 North Vietnamese was beaten off in less than 10 minutes by small arms, machine gun, and artillery fire from the alert and well-prepared Bravo Company 2nd Battalion troops. At 4:31 a.m., 20 minutes later, they came back. Diederich, "The intensity of their attack increased, and I was under assault aimed at my three left platoon sectors." Screams, shouts, and whistles split the night as the NVA swept down the mountain, straight into the smoke-clouded killing ground. Now all the mortars of my battalion and Tullys were turned loose, adding their 81mm high-explosive shells to the general mayhem. Rifleman John Martin, who was in Diederich's line, says, "We kept pouring rifle and machine gun fire and artillery on them, and then they broke and ran. I don't think we had any casualties, but they were catching hell." By now, the Air Force C-123 flare ship, Smokey the Bear, was overhead, and its crew was kicking out parachute flares nonstop. "We halted artillery illumination to conserve it for later use, if needed." Myron Diederich wrote, "The illumination proved to be of great value. It gave us the ability to see and place effective small arms fire on the enemy. I could see the enemy formations as they assaulted in my sector. My forward observer was able to see the targets and place effective artillery fire on the enemy. The enemy would wait until